Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday, April 12th. Good to have you with us. This week, the Iowa Supreme Court heard arguments for and against Iowa's six-week abortion ban. Later in the program, we'll have courts reporter for the Des Moines Register, William Morris, on. He'll talk about that case and give us the legal arguments. We'll also talk with him about some other very interesting court-related news. Before that, IPR's Zachary Oren-Smith on some changes to programs serving victims of sexual assault and domestic violence in eastern Iowa. Jason Clayworth of Axios on how Iowa is among the states where traffic deaths increased the most last year. That's distressing. We'll hear why that may be. Also, toward the end of the hour, we want to groove into the weekend because it's Friday. Mark Simmet will join us. First of all today, let's survey some highlights on activity this week at the Iowa State House. Robin Upsall joins us. Robin is Iowa Capitol Dispatch reporter. Robin covers the state legislature and politics. Robin, welcome back to our program. So glad to have you.
Hi, happy to talk with you again, Ben.
Let's dash through a number of things happening at the State House this week. The Iowa Senate approving a bill for Iowa school employees wanting to carry firearms on school grounds. What are the provisions of the bill?
Yep. So this is something that would create a training and permitting process through the Iowa Department of Public Safety for schools that want to have armed staff on the premises, as well as for the teachers who want to carry firearms while on school grounds. What it did was a little bit different from what the House has done in that it removed a school security grant program that would have provided funding for other related security measures like hiring a school police officer or a security guard to increase protections. This bill just focuses on the permitting and firearms aspect of this proposal.
Mm-hmm. And there's some qualified immunity there from criminal and civil liability?
Yep. So one of the big reasons that Iowa schools have not already implemented armed staff on campuses in some cases is that schools that have tried to have been denied liability insurance because of the risks that are posed in terms of if an accident happens, right? If a staff member does have an accidental discharge of a firearm, or a student, is able to get a hold of a gun, something like that. So what this does is provide qualified immunity in cases pursuant to the application of reasonable force. So not necessarily covering all of the situations that could happen in an accident, but if someone is, sustains injuries or is killed in relation to the use of that firearm in trying to, address a shooting or something, that would be covered.
Yeah. Of course, this legislation stemming from the tragic shooting January 4th, 4 months ago at the Perry High School, a lot of impetus coming from that tragedy. Let's move on. On Wednesday of this week, Robin, the governor signing a series of bills, including a measure making illegal immigration a state crime in Iowa. What changes are here?
Yep. So this bill is modeled after something that is currently being going through the court system right now that was passed by Texas last year. So what this law does in Iowa would be that anyone who has been denied entry, who has been deported or removed from the U.S. Would be able to be charged with an aggravated misdemeanor, and state courts would be able to order their deportation. Those are different right now because while they're crimes, they're federal crimes. This would make it state crimes these actions in Iowa and would allow state authorities to take action on those, to charge or attempt to order people to leave the country in these cases.
Mm-hmm. And why do Republicans and our governor say this is needed?
It's something that Reynolds has, you know, called for more action and been very critical of Biden and Democrats for not taking sufficient action on. She also recently sent a significant number of National Guard troops and law enforcement officers to Texas, to the state, the U.S.-Mexico border, to help with state efforts on enforcement of immigration law.
Yeah. And quickly, who opposes this new law now and why?
Yeah. So Democrats and advocates, particularly immigrants' rights advocates, oppose it, both because it is something that they say makes Iowa a much less welcoming place, is not realistic to enforce in comparison to Texas, because Iowa is not a direct border state. The Texas law that it was modeled after was or is being challenged in court, and there are not there are questions about, you know, if why pass it if this Texas law is also being under question currently.
Traffic cameras in the news again. It's been an issue that's been debated, surrounded by controversy for years here in Iowa. Addressed by a bill approved by the Iowa House this week. What are the provisions of this traffic camera bill?
Yep. So this bill incorporates some other pieces of legislation that have passed earlier this session. So local governments would still be able to have traffic cameras, but they would have to receive permits from the Iowa Department of Transportation, as well as have some regulations and standards set in regards to those, in terms of how much they can fine, what sort of speeding violations they can catch using these programs. It also requires that cities and counties provide justifications and explanations to the state for why this is needed for a public safety for improving public safety in their area.
Let's go back to also a bill, another bill signed by the governor this week. This one makes changes to Iowa's More Options for Maternal Support. It goes by the acronym MOMS, MOMS program. Remind us about this program and what changes were made to it and what prompted the changes.
Yep. So the MOMS program, or More Options for Maternal Support program, is something that was passed in a previous legislative session that provides state funding through grants to maternal health care organizations that discourage or encourage alternatives to abortion. So this is something that received an uptick in funding last year, as well as implementing some wider structure. However, that funding has not been able to be allocated because of an internal a problem with the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services not being able to find a third-party administrator to oversee the program and oversee the organizations, the so-called crisis pregnancy centers that would be receiving government money through this program. So because they have not been able, the department has not been able to find a third-party administrator despite a long search, what this does would give that control over to the HHS department directly so that they can move forward with actually allotting the money that's been given to them by the governor and the legislature.
Democratic lawmakers have criticized this whole program and also proposed some amendments that were unsuccessful. Tell us about that criticism.
Yep. So this is something that provides funding to pregnancy resource centers, also known as crisis pregnancy centers, which many critics, many maternal health care organizations say are not necessarily licensed medical organizations, and sometimes mislead patients, mislead pregnant people who are looking for medical support through someone that's licensed officially. They misrepresent themselves as doctors or as medical organizations. And then when they discourage abortion, that's not necessarily coming from the place of a doctor or from sound medical advice, is what groups like Planned Parenthood, but also many Democrats, have argued. So their issue with the larger program is this, and also the lack of support for other licensed medical care, medical maternal health care options that are available to many Iowans throughout the state.
Robin, the end of the session is coming. How soon?
The budgeting process, which is needed to wrap up session, is going along fairly smoothly. It's, of course, not confirmed whether exactly what day things will finish up. There are also still a few bills left to be reviewed in terms of major policy that both lawmakers and the governor have expressed interest in wanting to pass, those being a review and some cutting and merging of boards and commissions throughout the state, as well as making changes to the personal income tax and speeding up some of the changes that have been previously implemented in legislative sessions.
Okay, Robin Upsall, thank you so much. Iowa Capital Dispatch reporter, thank you for the survey of highlights from the State House activity.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, still plenty to come here on this News Buzz edition. Zachary Oren Smith will be along to talk about the University of Iowa plans to absorb its rape victim advocacy program into the Iowa City-based domestic violence intervention program. News during this Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We'll be back after a short break. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Some news during this is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The University of Iowa plans to absorb its rape victim advocacy program into the Iowa City-based Domestic Violence Intervention Program. Zachary Oren Smith joins me now, our Eastern Iowa reporter here at IPR, to tell us about the significance of it. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Ben.
So start off, please, by giving us some background. For those unfamiliar with these two programs, tell us about their missions in Eastern Iowa up to this point.
Yeah, so just over 50 years ago, a program was formed at the University of Iowa to support the survivors of sexual assault, of sexual violence in the area. And over a few years later, so that was the Rape Victim Advocacy Program. A few years later, the Domestic Violence Intervention Program was started in kind of as a project of RVAP. To offer services, particularly to the survivors of domestic violence, right? These kind of sister organizations for the last almost 50 years have been providing two really essential services for people, for Iowans in an 8-county region that are experiencing the worst day of their life, right? They're sending advocates to sexual assault examinations. They're sending You know, they're staffing the crisis hotline. They're providing what is a really key service. It's the kind of program that you may not be aware of it, but for the people that are attached to it, that have made use of these services, that staff these services, that volunteer, you know, these are high impact services that people are really attached to.
Right. Very valuable services for the victims of sexual assault, and it has been for many years, these services, very valuable. But
that's right.
Okay, so the University of Iowa dissolving its program into its rape victim advocacy program into the Iowa City-based domestic violence intervention program. Why is this happening?
To take a step back, if you look around, kind of zoom out and look around at how other regions handle this service, it's often a single organization that has both sexual assault services and domestic violence services kind of housed in the same organization. Because it is just by virtue of history, right, that here in Johnson County, for the 8-county service area, that we have, two different organizations kind of housing these two services. If you talk to the University of Iowa about their decision to shutter RVAP and move it to the Domestic Violence Intervention Program, they'll tell you, we've been planning to do this for some time, right? That we've been kind of moving, trying to get our ducks in a row to try to make this organization that really does service a region, not just Johnson County, not just Iowa City, not just the University of Iowa, but, a full region. They've been trying to make the moves for some time, and this was the kind of moment where they decided to do so.
Mm-hmm. I understand there are critics of this change. What are their voices saying?
That's right. Like I said earlier, these are important services, services that people have care quite a bit about. That are important to continue in our community. And there are many people that see this as connected to cuts being made to many kind of DEI coded institutions, programs, initiatives across the state, and particularly at the University of Iowa. And now, to be clear, the University of Iowa claims that these services will continue to be covered in full by the Domestic Violence Intervention Program. I spoke with one of the workers at the Domestic Violence Intervention Program. I mean, she was very clear to say that, while this has not been services that we've provided in the past, we will be working, they are working now to build a system of both UI funding, federal funding, state funding, and private donor funding to build the capacity that they need in order to provide these services across the coverage zone.
So in other words, Zach, going forward, those who need these valuable services won't notice a difference?
I think that's the key question, right? We want to make sure that, these are important services. We want to make sure that there is no lapse of service. We want to make sure that all of them become covered by DVIP, right? I think that's one thing that we're going to have to watch, right, as the University of Iowa determines how they're going to fund this organization, as the DVIP works to build that capacity. Will there be a lapse in coverage or are they able to bring these services over and have a really robust way of servicing people that, again, are experiencing the worst day of their life?
Zachary Oren-Smith, our Eastern Iowa reporter. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa is among the states where traffic deaths increased the most in the last year, in 2023. Jason Clayworth has been reporting on this for Axios in Des Moines. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us some more details about Iowa's traffic fatalities in this latest federal report.
Vehicle-related deaths in the state increased more than 11% from 22 to 23, and that was almost 40 more deaths, a total of around 376 last year. These are still estimate numbers in the report that just came out, the federal report that just came out from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Mm-hmm. And Iowa, distressingly, is one of the few states to see a rise in traffic deaths. Traffic deaths going down in other states?
nationally, deaths, traffic deaths are down roughly 4%. And the only states that had increases larger than Iowa's last year, Rhode Island, Kentucky, and Idaho. Traffic deaths is an issue that Iowa has been working on for years to try to lower. But what has been interesting, there are two key issues that have been going forward, and we're seeing a lot of legislative talk, and one of those is the hands-free driving issue. And so that's been a topic. And also there's been talk about, at least locally in the Des Moines metro area, a lot of talk about street diets. So you're seeing that talk of trying to make Iowa elite metro roads safer, and by slowing traffic down and doing various.
Let's talk a little bit about the legislative efforts here, because at the beginning of this session and previous recent sessions at the State House, for instance, the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, also the law enforcement, Iowa State Patrol, they want to pass hands-free driving law. Now, let's not be confused. Hands-free in this case, as opposed to if we were talking about autonomous vehicles, it would mean something different. Here, hands-free is something that allows drivers to use their phones for certain tasks without holding them in their hands, making calls, texting, using GPS, and so forth. And we had this distracted driving law passed in 2017 that was intended to curb cell phone use and the crashes from this type of distracted driving. But there's a loophole there, right?
Well, the loophole is that you can still use your phones. You just can't text. So there are all these various functions that our modern phones can do. But as long as you're not texting, it's still technically legal. It can be difficult to prosecute somebody that is contends that they were doing some other type of activity. And so these groups that you just mentioned, they have been pushing for multiple years to change that. And there are some studies that show states, including Missouri, our neighbor to the south, and Ohio, Michigan, that their distracted driving decreased following the passage of hands-free legislation. So there is some precedent that it works.
And the legislature this year, Jason, that went nowhere again this session?
Yes. And in previous years, we've heard some lawmakers voice concern that Iowans' rights could be violated through this law, that they have, privacies in their car, and that they need to take responsibility to use the technology responsibly. So that's the argument. I was just looking before we spoke today on groups that have registered in favor or opposition to these proposals, and I, at least for this year, I don't see any opposition. So it's something that you don't see groups that come out and are openly opposing this law, but there is opposition underneath some of this, and for those concerns that we just spoke about.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Des Moines metro area there. You had some data from that, and also from your reporting, a survey on how to improve traffic safety in the Des Moines metro area.
Yeah, that's correct. The Des Moines Metropolitan Planning Organization has been reviewing data. A lot of accidents that they're seeing are at intersections. Probably not a surprise. A lot of these are at night, on weekends, the type of accidents. This survey is asking residents for their input on what could improve safety in the Des Moines metro area. And so that's ongoing, and that will help the Metropolitan Planning Organization, as well as area governments in the future, plan projects street projects and, increase bike lanes or whatever it might be that are viewed as creating some safety measures to improve these rates that we're talking about.
Right. Obviously, some remedies needed there. Jason Clayworth, reporter with Axios Des Moines, talking about, among other things, how Iowa, in new statistics, among the states where traffic deaths increased the most last year in 2023. Jason, until next time, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's tackle three recent news items involving Iowa courts. The incredible story of a former IT worker at the University of Iowa who admits he lived under a stolen name for decades and now faces prison. Also, a lawsuit filed by the family of an Anamosa corrections officer killed in that 2021 prison attack, that lawsuit against the state of Iowa. And this week, the biggest court news in the state, the Iowa Supreme Court hearing arguments on whether Iowa's six-week abortion ban should go into effect. Telling us more about these three court news stories, William Morris, courts reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, William.
Hello. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Let's talk about the Iowa Supreme Court hearing those arguments this week. It was last year passed in a special session, the law banning abortions after fetal cardiac activity detected approximately in the sixth week of pregnancy, before many women are aware that they're pregnant. And then the court steps in, a district court judge steps in to block it. Why?
So this is a complicated question because there have been, I think this is now the sixth lawsuit between Planned Parenthood and Governor Kim Reynolds over the last nearly a decade. Basically, in the case of this law passed in a special session, the district court found that because of the Iowa Supreme Court's rulings in some of those previous cases, it was bound to find that under that standard, the law was unconstitutional. So now attorneys for the state are before the court asking it to review and change that standard and clarify that the bar for an abortion restriction in Iowa is pretty easy to meet.
Mm-hmm. So Thursday of this week, yesterday, justices heard, I understand, an hour of arguments, according to your reporting, from both sides, and you wrote about it in your article. Much of Thursday's arguments revolved around what exactly the Iowa Supreme Court meant in its recent abortion rights rulings, as you just explained. So in the court yesterday, what help us understand the legal questions the court must now decide.
Well, how long do you have? Because that's a lot.
We only have about just a few minutes. Can you put it in a nutshell?
Very quickly summarized, if something is guaranteed to Iowans as a fundamental right under the Constitution, there's a very high bar for any law against it. It has to pass what's called strict scrutiny, or else the courts will find it unconstitutional. The court ruled in 2022 that there is not a fundamental right to an abortion. Now they're arguing what the standard actually should be. Planned Parenthood believes that they should use an intermediate kind of standard, the same that used to be used by the federal courts under the Casey decision from the 1990s. That standard no longer exists at the federal level because of the Dobbs decision in 2022. Mm-hmm. And attorneys for the state say Iowa doesn't recognize any of these intermediate scrutinies. All that we need to prove is that we have a rational basis to have passed this law, and if we do, it's constitutional.
Okay, strict scrutiny and rational basis, those are the legal terms there that are being argued over. In the court, did you sense, you were a longtime courts reporter, any indications from the justices based on their questioning how the high court here in Iowa will rule? What did the justices have to say?
Well, it's always difficult to try to, interpret tea leaves on this. What I will say is that in 2023, we got a deadlocked 3-3, not a decision because they couldn't reach a conclusion, but the Iowa Supreme Court locked up 3-3 over on a similar case. And we had three justices saying it should be rational basis, this should be constitutional, and three justices who seemed to be on Planned Parenthood's side that there should be an intermediate level of scrutiny. One justice, Justice Dina Oxley, wasn't involved in that case. She was recused last year. She's back on for this case. And so if we have the same 3-3 split again, and again, it's hard to read tea leaves, but based on the questions yesterday, I think that's very possible. Then it will all come down possibly to what Justice Oxley says.
Yeah, and we're expecting the decision in June. We have less than a minute before we go to break, and we'll talk about some other cases after the break. But in these last few seconds, will this case finally settle the abortion standard here in Iowa, William?
It might. The state certainly wants it to. Planned Parenthood has argued that for various procedural reasons, it shouldn't, that the court should send the case back down to the district court for more litigation, which would almost certainly set up another appeal next year or the year after.
Okay. Stay with us, William Morris of the Des Moines Register, as we discuss some other cases he's been covering. Fascinating story coming up about a former IT worker at the University of Iowa who admits he lived under a stolen name for decades, now facing prison in a plea deal we hear about. Also, the family of an Anamosa corrections officer killed in that 2021 prison attack, suing the state of Iowa. We'll hear about that from William after a break. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking with William Morris, courts reporter for the Des Moines Register. Moving on to a story here that was first reported by the Cedar Rapids Gazette, laid out in court filings and press statements from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. William, this one reminds me of, you know, the book and the film Catch Me If You Can. A former IT worker at the University of Iowa admitting he lived under a stolen name for decades, now facing prison. This is a longtime University of Iowa hospital worker who was not who his colleagues believed he was. Tell us this story.
Well, I'm not even sure I can tell you all of it because we don't fully understand why this gentleman did what he did. But the information that we are getting from prosecutors and from court filings is that for more than a decade, this gentleman, William David Woods, was working for the University of Iowa as an IT worker. But he was not, in fact, William Woods. His real name was Matthew Kearns, and he was using the identity of another man who he had worked with briefly at a hot dog stand in the 1980s in Arizona.
Hmm.
Or scratch that, New Mexico. The real William Woods apparently learned in 2019 that this other man had been using his identity for decades at that point and went to a bank to try to get the accounts that were wrongfully opened in his name closed. But even though he had his legitimate Social Security card and California state ID card, the fake William Woods had obtained a copy of his birth certificate. He knew the security questions on the account. And the real William Woods ended up arrested and spent about 2 years in jail or in a mental facility for insisting that he was who he really was.
Wow. That is such an amazing story, like a Hollywood script here. So the University of Iowa police detective unraveled the scheme finally. Quickly, how did that happen?
Well, as I said, officials in California appeared to have entirely believed Mr. Kieran's story and that they prosecuted the real William Woods for identity theft. But after pleading guilty or pleading no contest to his charges in California, the real Woods kept trying to prove his own identity. Eventually learned where the fake Woods was working, contacted the University of Iowa, and they turned it over to the university's police department. The detective there did something that the previous law enforcement had not done. He got in contact with the real Woods' father in Kentucky obtained DNA samples and was able to do DNA testing to prove that the man in Kentucky was the real son of the man in, or sorry, the man in California was the real son of the man in Kentucky.
I don't know how you keep this all straight, but it's making sense. So let's continue on. So Kearns has now made a plea agreement and is likely to face sentencing. What?
Yes, he has pleaded guilty to identity theft and to making false statements to a federally regulated credit union, that referring to vehicle loans and other loans he took out while working for the University of Iowa. We do not know the date of sentencing yet, and the theoretical maximum he could face is more than 30 years, but that's very unlikely. But we won't know more detail until we see what the court filings say and to see what the attorneys say when they get before the judge.
Yeah, and what of the real William David Woods in California? Has he been able to get his life back together? Do we know anything about that?
He did an interview with the Los Angeles Times this week in which he talked about this. He's obviously very unhappy about everything that's happened. He mentioned possibly suing officials in California who sent him to a mental institution for insisting that he was who he was. He was, I believe, was homeless at the time that this first came together. I don't know his current situation, but I'm sure spending 2 years in custody like this did not help.
Right. And the UI has responded at all or issued a statement on this?
They told the Gazette that the fake Woods, Mr. Kearns, was let go as this information came out in the investigation, and that he was not, in their words, a senior administrative senior leader at the hospital, but beyond that, have not had much to say.
An amazing story of identity theft for over a decade. Let's talk about another case that you've been covering, and we have to go back for this one to that awful Anamosa prison attack of 2021. Robert McFarland, another employee of the prison, a nurse, Lorena Schult, died after suffering blunt force trauma after being attacked with a hammer by two inmates, Thomas Woodard, Michael Dutcher, while they were attempting to escape. Woodward and Dutcher both pled guilty, now serving life sentences without parole. Now, the family of the Anamosa State Penitentiary worker, this nurse, is suing the state. What is the lawsuit claiming?
Actually, to clarify, the nurse's family had already sued the state.
Okay.
The new lawsuit is on behalf of the corrections officer, Mr. McFarland.
Okay. Thank you for that correction. Tell us about this new lawsuit.
Well, it echoes a lot of what we've already heard from the Schulte family and from the bits of investigation and reports that we've seen since this attack in 2021. The family alleges that the prison was badly understaffed and that this was a known and longstanding problem, that the prison was over capacity, again, a longstanding issue, and that there were serious gaps in policies and procedures and equipment that were meant to keep people safe. So, for example, staff were supposed to be issued with emergency radios that they could use to call for help or notify their colleagues of any issues. Those radios apparently only intermittently worked. Also, and specific to the facts of this case, many of the maintenance tests in the prison were performed by prisoners who also could work for Iowa Prison Industries within the prison. In both cases, obviously, they need access to tools. But it seems, according to these lawsuits, that the prison did not have an effective system for monitoring who had tools, for regulating who was getting access to them, to make sure that the tools were being used only for legitimate purposes. And in the words of the attorney for McFarland's family, these two inmates were able to just sort of walk in and take what they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And this filing this week, very long, 130 pages, you say, naming 27 individuals. How do you expect this to unfold?
Well, we will see, as I said, it's just filed. in the last few days, so we will not see any response from the state for some time yet. But these are obviously very serious claims. The state may have various, you know, options to try to argue that they have immunity under different legal theories. But I would expect that this will take quite some time for the courts to get sorted out.
We have a few moments here, William. I wonder if you can sort of help us sort of picture what happened there in 2021, the circumstances of those killings that these lawsuits will be keeping in mind there when they look at possible fault here.
Well, again, based on all the court filings that we reviewed, the attack happened in the prison infirmary, where there were supposed to be, by policy, three guards stationed. On the day in question, there were only actually two guards stationed. As I mentioned, the prison was allegedly very short-staffed. And in fact, the new lawsuit claims that one of those guards wasn't really available. She was in a back room completing e-training modules on a computer, which was not her fault, was actually the policy of the prison, that you were supposed to do your training while on the job, while on duty. So that meant that when these two men, Woodard and Dutchard, came to the prison infirmary, they had hammers, they had an angle grinder, they wanted to try to grind through the bars on the window to make an escape, and there was only one corrections officer there to try to stop them. And Ms. McFarland was struck repeatedly in the head with hammers. Ms. Schulte was struck in the head. Another prison staff member was taken hostage for a while, and another inmate in the infirmary was badly injured.
And what is being sought in this latest lawsuit?
Well, we're a long way from finding out what monetary damages might look like, but talking to the attorney for McFarland's family, money cannot make this right. What they want is for the state to acknowledge the ways that they have, in their minds, put workers in harm's way, for accountability for the people who made or didn't make those decisions, and for promises and policy changes to make sure that corrections officers have the tools, have the support, and have the safety that they need to continue doing their job.
Okay. Well, a fascinating story there. And undoubtedly, we'll look for your follow-ups. William Morris of the Des Moines Register, courts reporter there. William, thank you for getting us up to date on these three court-related stories today.
It's been a busy week in courts. You're
sure.
Most welcome.
Sure has. And that just about brings us to the end of this NewsBuzz edition of River to River on this April 12th, 2024. I'm joined now by IPR's Studio One host, Mark Simmet, to groove us into the weekend. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Before we get to your selections, I was interested to see that 70 years ago, on this date in 1954, Bill Haley and the Comets recorded Rock Around the Clock. And what's interesting here, Mark, you probably knew this, but I didn't. The song was released in May, not a major chart hit, until July of 1955, when it was used as a theme song for the movie Blackboard Jungle. Then it went to number one on the pop hits. I've never heard of that movie. But anyway, some music history to start us off, Mark.
I have heard of Blackboard Jungle, actually. I think the story on that movie is that people actually rioted in theaters. I'm not sure why, due to the juvenile delinquent aspects of that movie, perhaps. You know, rock and roll, dangerous thing, rock and roll.
Indeed. Mark, groove us into the weekend. What do you have?
Well, first up, Ben, Phosphorescent. Now, this is singer-songwriter Matthew Hauk, who records as Phosphorescent, as is often the case these days. And he has a new record out. He's been doing this for over 20 years as Phosphorescent. And his new album is called Revelator. And this is Impossible House.
See the lies in the field. say the signs will reveal it, but they hardly ever do. And I know that can't be right. See, I was steadily moving, but now I'm steady standing still. So clearly set up to fail, I have to wonder what you're after. Of your skin, and I try to hold it tight. I try to shake off that feeling, but it just keeps slipping in, like the day into the night. I've been seeing you suffering, and I see you suffering.
Phosphorescent, the stage name of singer-songwriter Matthew Houck, a new effort by him, Impossible House. Oh, so nice. Let's go on to one more. We have time. Mark, what do you have?
Well, I have another singer-songwriter. Her name is Rosalie Middleman, but she goes simply by Rosalie, and she has a new record out. It's called Bite Down. She's a songwriter, guitarist, and vocalist, and this is really a classic singer-songwriter album, really classic singer-songwriter sound, but the selection I've chosen for you today is something to groove us into the weekend, and so therefore it rocks a little harder than the other songs on the album. It's Rosalie with My Kind.
Singer-songwriter Rosalie grooves us into the weekend, courtesy of Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One. My Kind, the title of that tune, will go out with it. Mark, thanks so much.
As always, my pleasure, Ben.
Today's program produced by Danny Gear. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.